Judiciary will come to order on the 19th of January, 7 minutes till the hour. Apologize, we delayed the beginning of the meeting today because some of us on the committee had an early committee meeting we had in transition. Senator Seekins will not be with us today. He sends his regrets. He's excused, and we will miss him. But in lieu of him, you have Huggins as your acting chair today. Hollis French is with us, Senator Terrio, and Senator Guess, and Charlie Huggins. Today we essentially have three bills, and our modus operandi will be to have those introduced, have testimony without an intent to move any of those, and I think it's fair to expect that Senator Seekins get an opportunity to see each of these, and it is our first meeting, and we will make some progress, but without an intent to move, and as time permits, we will go till 10:30. If time permits, we will go through all three, but we'll go as far as we get. With that, Senate Bill 200, Use of Force to Protect Self and Home, Vice President Terrio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today I'd like the committee to start to deliberate on Senate Bill 200, which I introduced at the end of the session last year. I was contacted by a constituent after that individual had learned of action in the Florida legislature by which a law was passed there by fairly overwhelming bipartisan support to make a similar change in the Florida statutes. In Florida, the new law was titled the Castle Law, which basically stems back to the Castle Doctrine or Castle Law, or originates from English common law, recognizing a person's home is their castle, and you certainly have the right to defend your home and self from attack. Today, I'm very interested in hearing expressed concerns from individuals representing the state agencies, law enforcement, to see if there is a particular part of the bill that where the wording causes concern that we might work with our drafters to try and ameliorate that concern. Nothing in the bill allows irresponsible action nor reduces in any way the ability of authorities to investigate specific actions of any and all parties engaged in the use of force. It does not permit or condone in any sense the use of unwarranted force. Senate Bill 200 establishes a baseline, as a baseline, the right of a person to stand their ground wherever they have a legal right to be and use whatever force is necessary to protect themselves or, in certain cases, others when they are in imminent danger. Basically, if a perpetrator is robbing you, breaking into your house, trying to steal your car with you in it, or trying to steal someone else's car with a victim in it, sexually assault a minor, threaten you with death or serious physical injury, is attempting to kidnap you or sexually assault you, you may use whatever force you deem necessary to defend yourself against the action. And if a person is in a place that they do not have a right to legally be and know to a certainty that they may retreat or know with a certainty that they may retreat to a safe place and not resort to force, then they have to take that option. So with that, I think that we're likely to hear some claims similar to what we heard when the legislature moved forward with the concealed carry amendments that were passed a number of years ago, that this is throwing our society open to an OK Corral mentality. That's certainly not the intent. I don't think that's been the result of the concealed carry, and I don't think that's been the result of this similar language to this passing in other jurisdictions. But again, I'm interested very much in hearing stated concerns and seeing if there is particular interpretations of the wording that need to be perhaps wordsmithed a bit with our legal drafters.
Thank you. And if, by way of comment, myself being from the Sunshine State and having a rather large family there, I think if you look at a number of eaches of what transpired in Florida and what brought this about, carjacking was a major piece of it, and it's one of the, and I can tell you that in talking to at least my family, they're highly supportive of this because the implication of what people were doing, and in my estimation, stand your ground will be hugely popular with Alaskans that live anywhere near in the neighborhood. I do, and I'm very supportive of this, but we will see as it goes. And our first witness?
See, I'm not sure who we've got. Do we have a sign-up list there?
Brian's online.
Okay. Brian Judy? Hello, Brian, you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yeah, Brian, did you hear what Senator Terrio had to say in the beginning comments?
I did.
Very good. Well, good to have you to join us. And, Brian, would you just give us your name, affiliation, and we are prepared for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, my name is Brian Judy, and I'm representing the Alaska members of the National Rifle Association this morning. And I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 200. As the sponsor of the bill indicated, the castle doctrine is an ancient common law doctrine. The origins going back at least to Roman law, basically saying that your home is your castle and you have every right to protect it. Actually, the principle of having no guilt for injuring or killing an intruder or burglar is found in the Old Testament. Exodus 22:2 says that if a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. So while the principle of the castle doctrine has roots in the Bible, English common law actually produced the castle doctrine and the specific precedent that there's no duty to retreat from court cases in the 14th and 15th centuries. Essentially, people have a right to be as safe and sound in their homes as the king was in his castle, and they may use all manner of force, including deadly force, to protect the home and its inhabitants from attack. Under existing Alaska law, there's already a provision of no duty to retreat if the person's on premises which the person owns or leases. Now, Senate Bill 200 does two main things. And the first component of Senate Bill 200 would extend that no duty to retreat to any place where the person has a right to be. And with respect to having no duty to retreat when outside the home, English case law has found that subjects or citizens had no more duty to retreat from assault than the soldiers who were assigned to protect the king. Under Senate Bill 200, if you're walking down the street and a rapist tries to drag you into an alley, or if you're walking through a parking lot and a kidnapper tries to drag you into his van, you do not have to retreat. And if you choose, you may stand your ground and fight and meet force with force. And this just makes common sense. And I want to actually get back to a point that Senator Terrio made. Again, this bill is not going to automatically give you carte blanche authority to start shooting when somebody puts their finger in your chest. You can only use what's reasonable force. The second significant component of this bill is the provision of immunity from civil liability for victims who have used lawful defensive force to prevent an attack. In other words, criminals and their families are prohibited from suing victims for injuring or killing the criminals who've attacked them. The Alaska legislature, and this committee in particular, deserves recognition for realizing that Alaskans care strongly about self-defense. Passage of the original concealed weapon permit back in 1994, improvements to the law over the years, and the ultimate repeal of the law in 2003, doing away with the requirement that a law-abiding individual obtain a permit and governmental permission prior to carrying a concealed weapon for self-defense, have been met with great success. Law-abiding citizens have exercised their rights with utmost responsibility. And the same is going to happen here. As Senator Terrio pointed out, I'm understanding that there are concerns being expressed about this bill, that gangs are going to have open season to shoot it out with each other. Fender benders are going to blood's going to run down the street of Anchorage. We heard these claims in Florida last year when the Castle Doctrine bill was run. The same claims we heard in 1987 in Florida, which was the first state to really start the movement of concealed weapon permit laws. We heard it in Alaska in 1994 when that first concealed weapon permit bill was passed. And it's just not going to happen. This is not going to provide an open season. The bottom line is that victims should have the protection of law, not criminals. Now, on behalf of the NRA, I do want to make two recommendations with respect to this bill. The first one is on page 2 of the bill, on line 6. It talks about self-defense. And it's our belief that rather than just self-defense, a person should be justified in using deadly force to defend herself or another person. So we would suggest that you consider that amendment. And second, I'm going to refer to the Florida bill here for just a second. In addition to unambiguously removing the duty to retreat and providing immunity from civil liability for defending against a violent attacker, that well-publicized Florida bill also provided an absolute presumption that anyone who unlawfully and forcefully enters your dwelling, residence, or occupied vehicle is there to do harm, and therefore any manner of force can be used against that person without fear of prosecution or civil suit. And I want to just read you about three sentences from the Florida Times Union, the Florida mainstream press, who, after many years of hyperbole, finally got it. With respect to this bill in Florida, they wrote, and I quote, "The law is long overdue. Criminal actions have consequences. There should be few questions asked when an intruder invades someone's home or car and winds up dead because of it. Victims, not intruders, should have the law on their side." That sums it up. And I would strongly suggest that such language, providing the presumption of reasonableness when somebody has forcefully entered your home or your occupied vehicle, should be added to this bill. The NRA would be happy to provide suggested language if necessary. With that, I would just urge your support for Senate Bill 200.
Questions for Mr. Judy? Brian, in your tracking Florida's precedents, have there been any instances where it's been invoked?
Can I ask who's speaking?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Senator Huggins.
Oh, hi, Senator Huggins. You know, I have not heard, and that's that's probably the key point. With all the talk about concealed weapon permits and all the talk about now this bill and providing self-defense, it's really not changing anything other than, you know, what's going to happen after the fact. Law-abiding citizens are responsible individuals, and they're not going out and opening fire on the Avon lady when she gets too aggressive with her sales pitch at the front door. It's just not happening. And we don't expect any problems. All we expect is that when these cases go to court, hopefully in obvious cases they won't go to court, and that's a key point, but hopefully in cases that do end up in court, law-abiding citizens who have found to use reasonable, justifiable self-defense are not going to be finding themselves the victims for a second time.
Senator Terrio?
Yes, Brian, thank you. Can you tell me what action is currently going on across the country with other legislative jurisdictions and consideration of similar language after Florida passed their law? How many other states are you aware of that moved in the similar direction?
Well, you know, a lot of sessions are, like Alaska, are just going in right now. And I know that this has been introduced from coast to coast. I mean, I know for a fact that that in the states I cover, it's introduced in Washington, it's introduced in Idaho, it's being talked about in Utah. Actually, Utah has a pretty good law, so there's really not much that needs to be done there. States in the Midwest and back east are introducing it. And it's important to point out that Florida bill, again, had three components. It was the one component that's not in this bill, and that's the absolute presumption that anyone who breaks in or forcibly intrudes in your home or occupied vehicle is there to do harm. The second is the unambiguous removal of the duty to retreat. And the third is the immunity from prosecution when having used lawful self-defense. Now, some of those components are in most states, but very few states, I don't know really if any state other than Florida has it. So I expect that this legislation, either strengthening the existing law or adding the components that aren't in, you know, adding any one or multiple of the three components that aren't in every state law, is going to be introduced in probably dozens of states this year.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Guest.
Thank you. I have a question for either Brian or the sponsor. In reading page 2, lines 9 through 15, and maybe somewhere else in the bill, if I'm at the mall and someone shoots at me and I shoot back, if I shoot back, then I'm not liable for what I do, or I'm not liable if I hit the person who shot at me. I would like to think that this is a hypothetical, but with some of the things that have gone on, at least in my hometown, it's not. So can you explain kind of in that situation how this would work? Either the sponsor or Brian.
Mr. Chairman, I'll jump in. You would not be liable if, in fact, you hit the person who attacked and killed them. You would not be liable for that action. Now, this doesn't remove, I mean, you can't take out your gun and just shoot wildly into the crowd. It doesn't remove your duty with regards to that type of action. But if, in fact, you took out the aggressor, then you would be exempt from prosecution.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Senator French.
Thanks. Mr. Judy, it's Hollis French. The way I understand it, this essentially extends the castle doctrine to anywhere I have a right to be. It's sort of like the world is my castle doctrine. And I guess my question is, maybe you or somebody else knows, what places do I have a right to be? Do I have a right to be at the mall, or is that a right that the mall can you know, deny me access for any reason? I obviously have a right to be on any public place, a sidewalk, a road, you know, things of that nature. But do I have a right to be in a bar? Do I have a right to be in a pawn shop? I guess I'm curious about, you know, whether this has any practical implications. Do I have a right to be in my neighbor's house? Are there any practical limits to where this law would apply, or does it essentially now apply statewide?
Mr. Chairman, just let me weigh in on that. Certainly, if you know, I have a right to control who's in my house. You know, if I tell my neighbor you're no longer welcome here, he doesn't have a right to be there. You have a right to be out on the public street, but we know there are ordinances where the police can mark block off a street, and there's a fire in the building, they can put a cordon around it, and you can't go across the barricade. I think the law would operate within the bounds of all those other laws with regards to, do you have to a right to be in the mall before it's open for business? No, you don't. Do you have a right to be in the mall if you have done something and they have got a restraining order against you? No, you don't. So I think it interplays with all of those existing checks and balances on your exercising of those rights.
If I might, in that, and I will speak for some of the constituents that I represent. People are tired of having somebody in the mall shoot at them, and their number one concern is, if I shoot back, am I going to be the person that is the big bill payer out of this? And as Senator Terrio said, it's not about shooting at other people in the mall, but in fact, your instinct is there is some degree of protection if somebody shoots at you, so you can protect your family, your life, and your friends. And that, I don't know the specifics of how this applies, but I think clearly, people that live in the neck of the woods where I do, called Mat-Su, they see the wisdom of the trend of this and what the essence of what it represents, and I wish my name was on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing I do believe I did mention, and but I want to make it very clear that there is no, you know, that law enforcement officers, that you have no right to, you know, take a shot at a law enforcement officer who is in the course of his duties, has, you know, followed the correct procedures for identifying himself, or if you reasonably had a, you know, reason to know that he was a police officer, you know, there's protections built into the bill specifically for law enforcement officers conducting their duties.
Other questions, comments? Senator Guest?
Yes. Page 2, line 10. We inserted to a certainty, and now this is the first day back in judiciary, not being an attorney, and we've been through knowingly and intentionally and all of that, and knows to a certainty versus knows. Can you explain, or maybe someone can explain, if that's just law clarifying something, or if that actually means two different things?
Mr. Chairman, it is two different things, and okay. We have personnel here from the Department of Law who has expressed some concern with that that verbiage. That's a very high standard.
Okay.
So I expect that we're going to hear about that.
I think this is a good point that we bring the Department of Law representative would come forward, please. Department of Law, are you here? Hi.
Saw me.
We're good to see your smiling face again.
Thank you. For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Department of Law. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill. I hadn't signed up to testify, but I'd be happy to answer questions. And I think what Senator Terrio was referring to is we met with his staff and appreciated the opportunity to meet with his staff to express some concerns about some items in the bill. And one of the issues that we raised was this page 2, line 10, to a certainty. I do believe it is a higher standard than what's currently the law, which is that you have a duty to retreat if you know that with complete personal safety and with complete safety to others, you can avoid the necessity of using deadly force. When you add to that to a certainty, I think it bumps it up. Our concern is already the prosecution has the obligation to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's a very high standard. We have difficulty prosecuting the gang shootings in the parking lot as it is under our current law. If you add to that this to a certainty, it's proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the person didn't know to a certainty. It's almost an impossible standard. It seems to me there's always going to be some doubt. This seems to me higher than a reasonable doubt, but it's not defined, and that I guess is another question and a concern that it's not defined. And as lawyers and giving jury instructions to jurors, that's a common question that, you know, you immediately get from a juror is, well, what does this mean? What does to a certainty mean? And I think they're going to want to know that.
Secretarial.
Mr. Chairman, Susan, could you talk just a little bit more? I want to be sensitive to the whole issue of, you know, gangs. You know, well, he fired at me first, and well, you both went to the playground or wherever with guns, itching for a fight. Is there a sensible way of dealing with that? Would it make sense to just say, if the activity was part of any kind of gang interaction, there's no protection? I mean, what would make sense?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, you know, we wrestled with this, I think, 2 years ago now in the governor's omnibus crime bill, trying to sort of carve out some of those areas where you don't get to use self-defense. And what we carved out at that time was if you are engaged in a felony drug transaction, you simply don't get to claim self-defense. I believe the other exception, I don't have the language in front of me, was if you are promoting a gang objective, you're engaged in promoting a gang objective. I think we could try to look at, and that's what we told your staff we would do, is try to work on if there were some ways to get it. You know, we support giving lawful citizens the right to protect themselves, their families, and others. You know, we fully support the concept here. Our concern is that this is also going to protect the bad guys because, you know, they're going to say, well, I had a right to defend myself, even if they were up to no good. And we're going to work on perhaps coming to you with some proposed narrowing down to get exactly at those. And we appreciate you being willing to consider those.
Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you. Obviously, the right to self-defense predates government. It's just a fundamental right, and I appreciate Senator Terrio's bringing us this bill so we can have a discussion about it. My question for you is, have you been in touch with any of the prosecution agencies in Florida that have now been dealing with this law for, I suppose, 6 months to see whether it's working out as intended? That is, are people more able to resist carjackers and evildoers in public, or are they
being faced with drug dealers who now have sort of plausible self-defense claims where they didn't have one before.
Senator French, through the chair, we have not, but that is our intent, and it may be, as a gentleman testified just prior to me, that, you know, we have these concerns, and they may not, you know, merit the concern. It's sort of a maybe a knee-jerk reaction by the prosecution, but we do intend to do that. We've started doing some research with Florida, and I understand Washington has had a similar law for quite a few years, and so it is on our intent to find out if it has created problems or they haven't been able to prosecute cases they think they should have been able to because of the law. But right now I'm not able to give you any examples of where it has been a problem.
If I can just follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. I read the newspaper like most people do, and there was an article about this bill in the newspaper, and they quoted Rex Butler, who's a well-known criminal defense attorney, and Rex Butler, when informed of the general thrust of the bill, said he was somewhat joking, but he said, "That's huge. That's great. When can they sign it?" Because he at least perceived it as a avenue to make it more difficult for the state to prosecute gun crimes should the bill be implemented. It may be that he's wrong. It's hard right now, I know, from my own experience, and I think Ms. Parks would agree. Getting over the self-defense hurdle is very, very difficult. The flip side of that, or the other side, is that citizens should absolutely feel entitled to defend themselves. That's a fundamental right, as I said at the beginning. And so I'll be eager as the committee explores this bill to find out if there's a problem, you know, let's fix that problem. You know, and I guess I'd be alert to, or I would solicit from anyone listening or any of the other committee members, instances of citizens having failed to defend themselves when they should have, citizens being prosecuted for having defended themselves when they shouldn't have been prosecuted. Things like that would help me sort of get a grip on where the bill would be useful. But of course, part of the problem is that self-defense cases are very, very fact-driven. They're very, very dependent on the exact circumstances right at that moment. And so sometimes it's hard to draw sort of a big lesson from what's happened. But I am soliciting, you know, stories, I guess, about where citizens feel the law is not protecting them.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a
yes,
comment
yes.
in response. Yes. Thank you. I guess one thing I would just like to comment with the discussion, you know, right now you have the right to use deadly force in a public place or anywhere under a lot of circumstances. The example of talking about someone's grabbing you and about to kidnap you, it's really nearly impossible to retreat with complete safety from a kidnapping. So if someone pulls out their gun and shoots someone who's trying to drag them away, right now that's protected under current law. I mean, you're entitled to use deadly force in self-defense of serious injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, robberies in any degree, which frankly covers carjacking. I think Section 4 clarifies that and kind of expands it a little bit. But even right now, if someone tries to pull you out of your vehicle, you know, with a gun to take your car, that's a robbery. And you, you know, can use deadly force if you feel you're unsafe. So a lot of this is already covered. Our biggest concern, frankly, is the innocent bystander issue, I think, that Senator Guess raised, because you can't shoot wildly, but we also don't have a requirement that people be a good shot. And there are cases, and we've had cases in the office where we haven't been able to prosecute, where an innocent person, you know, walked in the middle of gunfire. And if you have a right to shoot in self-defense just because you accidentally miss the bad guy and shoot an innocent person, the self-defense covers you. You had a right to return the deadly fire. And that really is where our concern comes in with the expansion of all these public places that people have a right to use deadly force, even if they could retreat with complete safety.
Ms. Parks, in the case of civil liability, does this bill have any impact on civil liability?
Mr. Chairman, the Section 1 that gives the, you know, immunity if you properly used self-defense. I'm not a civil lawyer, But in looking at it and talking with the Department of Law, we've got no concerns about with Section 1. It seems appropriate if you appropriately used self-defense to protect yourself or someone else that you shouldn't be held civilly liable just because the standard of proof is a little different or you get some, you know, wacky ruling from a jury.
Right.
But that does not raise any concerns for the department.
You know, you may recall, but sort of sent shockwaves through our community in Mat-Su here in the last 3 or 4 years. We had a church that was broken into, a pastor that took direct action and went to court over that. And I don't remember if it was homicide, whatever it turned out to be, was found not guilty. But, you know, could you tell me that what sort of implications this bill would have had potentially on a scenario like that, not the specific case, but a scenario of that sort?
Certainly. I don't think this bill would actually change that scenario because, well, again, I think as Senator French said, everything is very factually based, and I'd probably have to get into the specifics of that. It would come down to, in a case like that, the pastor, someone had, he had a right to be in that church. Obviously, he wasn't in the church when it was broken into. He, you know, somebody you go over to find out what's going on. The issue would be whether he reasonably believed he was in, you know, fear of death or serious physical injury. And I think that's what that case came down to. And if you're not in fear, you don't have the right to use deadly force, regardless.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, I had some discussion with my staff on that case, and I think the specifics were that the perpetrator was actually fleeing.
That's correct.
And so I don't think this bill would have kicked in there because the robbery, the break-in was done. The person was down the driveway and was shot.
Yeah. We figured out what the jury felt about it.
Right. Right, yeah. And I guess getting back to comments that have been made, I think there is a lot of public support for people, you know, feeling like they want to be able to protect their homes, their churches, their places of employment, their businesses, which, you know, is another way to go to perhaps narrow down and something we're looking at maybe language to expand the areas beyond what it currently is, but maybe not necessarily anywhere you have a right to be, like a sidewalk or store.
Okay. Other questions? Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Parks?
Not at this time. Again, just thank you for letting me comment. I appreciate Senator Terrio and actually also Representative Coghill, who's got a similar identical bill. His staff has also met with us to hear our concerns and has also expressed willingness to look at any suggestions we have, and we appreciate that.
Okay. Well, as usual, it's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the audience that would like to testify, either professionally or personally? Okay, thank you very much. Are there other observations or comments by committee at this time? Okay. Senator Terrio, unless you desire otherwise, we'll set Senate Bill 200 aside.
Yes,
and be continued.
I'll work with the chairman's staff too, as we come up with a CS that incorporates
good
changes.
Good. Okay, we'll take a short 5-minute recess and come back to order. Presently, we have Senator Terrio and Huggins in the room, but we will continue on understanding Senator Bunnity that we will go through this to a certain point, time permissible. Plans not to move it today, but to get the initial hearing. And we have online Anna Fairclough. Are you there, Anna?
I just got a note here that she's gone to Senate Finance for a moment. She's going to be back.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, prime sponsor, Senate Bill 218, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just coincidentally, Senate Finance, where I'm dividing my attention, is discussing a sexual assault bill as well. So, this seems to be a topic of concern across Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you taking the time to address this bill that is of great concern to a number of Alaskans. A short summary of the bill, Mr. Chairman, for the record, well, for the record, Con Bundy, Senate District P, assisted with my capable, able staff, Warren Rice. This bill, Senate Bill 218, would increase sentencing time for the most egregious unclassified and Class A sexual felonies, particularly those against a minor, where it would raise the minimum sentence to 25 years. It also increases sentencing in unclassified and Class A sexual felonies in where they involve an adult to 20 years. It restructures and increases sentencing in Class C and Class B sexual offenses. It requires periodic polygraph testing for sexual offenders who are on probation and parole. And it implements some changes in the sex offender registry and reporting laws that currently exist. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm sure you're all well aware that in Alaska, we have the very dubious reputation of having the highest per capita sexual abuse rate in the nation. It is 70% greater than the next highest state. It is not a reputation that we can be proud of. And what perhaps is even more tragic, as many people in who've worked in this arena know, is that's the reported cases are just the tip of the iceberg. There are many, many cases for lots of reasons that go unreported. So if we have this dubious record going now, you can only imagine how much actual abuse, rape, sexual abuse of a child is going on in Alaska. And it's really just time to put a stop to it. We have certainly have laws against that activity now, but they're obviously not working very well. And we need to make some serious, and I might add, expensive changes, potentially expensive changes, because while the state can be criticized for its level of spending in some arenas, when it comes to preventing victims of sexual assault, that truly is an area of essential state spending, and I know this is the Finance Committee, but it is an area of concern for all of us. But I would suggest that it is an investment in the quality of life of Alaska that does need to be made. I had mentioned that a part of this bill does involve polygraph testing. We all know they're not admissible in court. But in other states where they've used this for people who are in probation and parole, it has worked well at reducing the recidivism rate, to the point that I have been told that there are people convicted of sexual assault in other states where they do have the polygraph who have asked to be transferred to Alaska, where we do not have a polygraph. Now, there may be other reasons they want to come to Alaska, but I think the polygraph is a significant part of that and something that is the tool that we can look forward to. In your package, Mr. Chairman, there's a report that's been recently released that does indicate that, unfortunately, treatment does not achieve the ends that we want to achieve. It is doing very little to reduce reoffending in the area of sexual assault and sexual abuse of minors. And that, but we do have one tool that will certainly allow us to reduce the amount of re-victimization, of recruiting new victims, and that is by putting these people in jail for long periods of time where they cannot then create new victims. I would like to give my thanks to Senator Guess, who has worked with me and strengthening this bill and sharing her advice and her research, and folks in Department of Law, Mr. Quinelli and Ms. Sparks, and certainly from the Department of Corrections, Ms. Parker. This has been a collaborative effort, and I would think one of the times that the legislative process, that old saw about the legislative process that you don't want to want sausage or laws made, this is one of the times that we can be proud that we're doing something that's going to help protect vulnerable people in Alaska, our children, and reduce this terrible record that we have of the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation. With that, I know there are other people who would like to testify. There are some adjustments to the bill. There is an amendment out there, and I believe you have a CS before you that perhaps you ought to adopt.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Getz.
I move adoption of CS4, Senate Bill 218 /I version.
Is there a second? Not required. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any objection to the CS? Okay. Without objection, so adopted. Senator Getz, since you are also a sponsor on this, do you have any comments at this time on the bill?
No, I'd like to thank Senator Bundy for working with me and helping combine some of the things that I had, focusing on sexual abuse of a minor. And it's been a long time coming, I think, in this state for us to actually finally take this measure. So and I'm willing to help answer questions.
Okay, Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, and for Senator Bundy or or Senator Getz, my apologies. I was reading some of the information here. Did you? I just need a brief explanation of the amendment now that goes
sure.
with the I version.
Yes, and we can do amendments now if you want, Senator Huggins, or I hadn't.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to know.
Yeah, let's stand by on the amendment process, but if you could just answer
okay.
the question. So.
Okay. The amendment before you, which will be amendment number one at some point, what this does is move sexual assault of a minor threes that have to do with sexual penetration to sexual assault of a minor two. So it's basically saying that in this state, if you have sexual penetration of a minor, you're either going to be a SAM 1 or a SAM 2. What it also does inadvertently is say if there's an attempt to sexual penetration, then it's a SAM 3. And right now what happens is if an attempt goes to SAM 4, which is a misdemeanor. So it's keeping anything that has to do with sexual penetration of a minor in a felony classification. And it's also saying that we as a state, you know, see sexual penetration as a serious crime, and those should be SAM 1s or SAM 2s. Does that help in the explanation as you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it does. And actually, that pleading down was a line of questioning that I have for the Department of Law. And when you say that it will keep everything in the felony category, I wasn't sure when things get pled down, if there's a weak case, how are you going to absolutely keep it in the felony category?
And I'm going to look to Susan Parks to come up. I can talk to you about the intent of it. And sexual abuse of a minor, you kind of have to think of it in kind of two areas. There's sexual penetration and sexual contact. So we're dealing just with sexual penetration, which has a definition in statute. So those are the ones where we're working on making sure that those stay in felonies. There is sexual contact, which can be pled down to a misdemeanor. So depending, I think, on the case, on whether it stays in sexual penetration or it gets moved to sexual contact, that would be my response. But maybe when the Department of Law testifies, they can walk you through SAM cases and pleading down and how those are dealt with.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, these are not always pleasant things to discuss, but the impact on a minor in any act that would involve penetration, both mentally and physically, is far more egregious than someone who may have diminished emotional or mental capacity, who doesn't restrain their impulse to fondle someone. And I think this is Senator Guess's amendment, and I'll leave her major explanation to her. But in my mind, there's some serious concern about the victim here, and trying to not overly punish people who make an impulsive, foolish mistake, but also to send a very clear message that our society views anything that involves penetration as a very serious offense against society.
If I might, at this time, I'd like, we have Anna Fair. Anna, are you there? Anna? Anna Fairclough?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank you. Anna, in the interest of your time and in the committee process, we'd like to hear your comments. If you would just give us your name, affiliation, and your testimony, please.
Thank you, sir. This is Anna Fairclough. I'm testifying today as the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape. As an organization, we support SD.
Anna, stand by one. I know I can't hear you very well, but.
If she could just speak up to
the. Yeah, Anna, could you speak maybe a little more directly into the microphone?
I'm trying. Is that better?
Yes, please.
Okay.
If you could just start from the top.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. My name is Anna Fairclough, and I'm speaking today as the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape. STAR has been in existence for over 27 years in the state of Alaska, helping victims of sexual violence. What we note and why we support SB 218 is it tightens the restriction and the accountability for perpetrators on victims of sexual assault. What I found speaking with Chief Monaghan here in the Anchorage Police Department is we have cyclish perpetrators that come onto our streets, and it averages about 8 years because that's about how long we put them in a correctional facility. And so I would just echo what Senator Bundy has presented to you, in that we need to have harsher and longer sentencing, really to have Alaskans stand up and know that there is a consequence to breaking the law. What we find at STAR is that if victims are afraid, and we have systems in place which is very nice to let them know when their perpetrator is coming back on the street, but the cycle continues and it only escalates further. What we actually teach felons to do, at least felons of sexual assault, is to be better criminals. And Senator Bundy is absolutely right that they need to be put away for a long time the first time. In addition to that, what we've found through research, and I don't have the research with me today to cite it for you specifically, but anecdotally, the older a person gets as they age out, and our perpetrators tend to be male. And so as the male ages in the process, they're less likely to perpetrate. So if you have a first offender that you're putting away for 12 years, and now you're going to put them away for 24, we have a greater likelihood that that person is not going to come out and reoffend. So that sexual drive that is deviant is repressed the older they are. So I like that you're going to put somebody away for 24 years. And just, I haven't really read the amendment. Your staff did provide it for me this morning. I'm not sure of the entire consequences and ramifications, but it appears that STAR would support that also. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions and encourage you pass SB 218. Senator Bundy has worked very hard and has contacted me on numerous occasions to make sure that this would be beneficial to victims.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Fairclough? Anna, it appears we don't have any questions this time, but based on your expertise and in your community standing, we would like to be able to potentially hear from you in the future, and I know we have your phone number and address, and with your permission, when Senator Seekins gets back, I will pass on to you that you're probably willing to help us out in the future if so required.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have anything else you'd like to add from the sponsor's perspective?
Just be available for questions. Let me check my extended memory and see if there's anything I left out. apparently not at this time.
Yeah, Senator Bundy, let me just ask you, this is just my take. The essence of what has gone on in our society and what you're biting at, that trait, is we've had this huge, let's call it secret for lack of a better term, but it's a bubble that ripples through the generations because the abused becomes the abuser. And we've suddenly start to come to grips, or over time we begin to come to grips with the fact that recidivism rate is so great, and that other factors that though we've had a little bit of success in some ways of abating the challenge of what this represents, that in some cases putting people out of reach of victims may be an alternative we have to exercise, which means longer terms. Is that halfway accurate?
I think that reflects the intent of a major part of the bill. I guess from a non-therapist point of view, just from someone who's been around this earth for a while, trying to convince someone when they're not under your immediate control to change their basic sexuality is a very difficult task, and I would say, or affecting me personally, it'd be impossible. And in the case where people who are not abiding by the mores of society, about all we can do at this point. And maybe one day we will find a magic pill that will help them change to a more normal sexual form of sexual expression. Until that time, all we can do is protect the victims, or the potential future victims. And I, at this point, the only thing I know of is what you suggest, and that is they have to go to prison for a long period of time.
Yeah. No, in that respect, are there any minimum agencies that you want to be able to testify on this bill?
As I said, the Department of Corrections, Department of Law have been very helpful in crafting the bill. I certainly would invite them, if they would like to add information about the bill, to be able to testify, and of course I appreciate them being available for questions. I know there are folks who are in the Sexual Abuse Network who are interested in the bill, and they certainly may have wish to make some comments.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bundy, thanks for bringing us this bill. This has been an object of my work for some time, and I share with you disgust really at our state's terrible ranking with respect to this problem, and I'm willing to try almost anything to fix it. I had some legislation a couple of years ago on the subject you were helpful with, as well as other members of the body. And one of the things I learned during the research on that bill was about polygraphing, and I guess I wanted to share that piece of information. If you take a convicted sex offender and take that person in for an interview and ask him, how many victims did you have before this person that we arrested you for, the offender will say 3, 4, 5. If you hook that person up to a polygraph and ask that individual, how many victims did you have before this offense, the number goes up by a factor of 10. It's just astonishing to find out how many victims there are before the victim that actually put this person in prison, how many of those there are before the conviction. And so I think, particularly with the polygraph testing, you're really onto something. And I think it'll help, find more victims for, perhaps they can be referred to the Office of Victims' Rights and something can be done, and B, sort of awaken folks to the idea that there's a iceberg out there that's submerged that we're unaware of. Turning to the part of the bill that deals with the increased sentences, I'm sympathetic. Something has to be done. And I guess this is more for the Department of Law, but I'll just throw it out there for now so the folks that are listening can hear my question and think about it or prepare for it. The last time we have good data on this is from a Alaska Judicial Council report from 2004. And in that report, they were actually looking back in time to offenses from an earlier period. But then there's always been this difficulty, this pressure in the DA's office to do something with a weak case. And what you have done traditionally is reduce the charges and to get it down to a place where you can come to an agreement between the prosecution and the defense and settle a case without every single case having to go to trial. At that time, 91% of sex assault in the first degree charges ended up in reduced charges, 91%. And 79% of SAM 1 cases, sex abuse of a minor, and 83% of sex assault 2 offenses were ending up in reduced charges, dismissals, or acquittals. That's my concern. My concern is that we, you know, reduce the pressure on the system because of a 30-year term. We reduce that pressure by squeezing the bubble down to some lower conviction. And so I guess that's something I'll be listening to the Department of Law speak to, and that's just something I wanted to put out there.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, it is a valid concern, and I certainly acknowledge your expertise and interest in this area. As all sentences have been ratcheted up, should there be the squeeze down, there's still going to be substantially more time in jail, even if they plead and are able to plead down to a lesser level of offense. So that's one response. The other is I'm very aware that this will demand more court time. And but maybe we, as a body reflecting the public's will, will suggest to prosecutors that we don't want to plead out. We are willing to pay for you taking these cases to trial. Now, when there's not a strong case, of course, we have to use caution and make sure that we're not hanging judges or something like that. But where there's a reasonable case, at least from my point of view, I don't want the prosecutor to plead down just because it's expedient. I think I'd much rather have them send the very clear message.
Thank you very much, Senator Bundy, and we appreciate it.
Senator Huggins, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Guest.
I just wanted to respond to the first part of Senator French's comments about the polygraph, and I agree, and I think we're in agreement on that. Page 5, Section 6, just to bring everyone's attention to that, is, I think, a very important part of this bill, because what it does is ensure that anyone, when they do get off, is on automatic probation and therefore can be polygraphed. And it's one of the ways that we can actually protect the public and keep sex offenders who've gotten on jail, if they get off, we don't need to go back to trial. They're on probation for a certain amount of time. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think it's an important part of the bill on the protection side and helping on the polygraphs.
Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that it's a very attractive part of the bill, and to me, almost the most important part of the bill. I mean, that is somebody that we have identified through a jury, conviction. That person is one of the deviant, is one that has shown deviant behavior in our society. Okay, and I remember seeing 2020 or something on this when it started to be used across the country. And to me, the idea that as part of their ongoing probation, the question can be asked, not only have you engaged in any aberrant behavior, but have you started thinking about it? Mm. And if they see a pattern, even of thinking about it, have you been hanging around schoolyards? Have you been shadowing women in the malls or whatever? That steps can be taken in probation, perhaps to revoke probation, and back in the slammer that person goes. And we know that person's of a very, there's a very high likelihood that they will reoffend. I'm just trying in my own mind to looking at these fiscal notes that have *****, because they have no idea how much this is going to cost, whether that isn't the most important part of this bill, to tell you the truth. And so I want to have some conversation with the Department of Law about that. Again, trying to get the most impact out of a change in the statute for the dollars that are spent. And Ever since I was chairman of the House Finance, I've always tried to be mindful about what it is that we trigger. We're you know, expressing some dissatisfaction with the plea bargaining, but yet when we leave town, the agencies have to make the system work with the amount of money we allocate to them. And these agencies usually don't have carry forwards. They're usually back for supplemental. So we just have to keep in mind the cost. And it seems to me like the polygraphing is a very good way of getting impact on those people that are very high risk of reoffending, to get them back in jail at the minimum cost to the state.
Senator Bundy, one more question in that respect. The systemically, Department of Corrections has the polygraph responsibility. Would that where it would lie, Department of Corrections? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the offender will have to bear some of that cost.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
And one final comment on the polygraph and Senator Terrio's comments was, again, not being a trained therapist, I've got to, in my mind, believe that these perpetrators are in a pretty heavy state of denial, that the woman really wanted the event, they were really doing the child a favor, just serious denial. So they might actually be very good at deceiving people and themselves, and I think the polygraph will help stop that deception. And obviously, acknowledgement of a problem is the first step if you're going to regain any control. I would comment about the sentencing, however. It costs a great deal of money to keep a person in jail. However, there are just some costs that a reasonable society is going to have to bear, particularly in light of our incredible sexual assault rate, that I'm not unaware of the fiscal impact, but it's one that I think we should very seriously consider bearing.
Yeah. And one comment on behalf of at least my constituents. You know, the pedophiles are one of those that most of us can't even imagine the implications, but it's so rampant. And, you know, I think that the average Alaskan, when they pinch themselves and think about it, that this goes a long ways at biting at that, and I salute you for that.
Well, and you, obviously someone who's in jail for 25 years can't create a victim that will now be set down a path that will create new victims.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Oh, and could I just take one more moment
to
publicly acknowledge the hard work that Lauren has done on this.
Yeah.
I get to sit in front of the camera, but she has really done yeoman's work here.
Well, Lauren has a reputation that precedes her, and we're proud that you have her working for you.
She shows good judgment in who she works for.
Yeah. Okay, we have what's commonly referred to in some circles as P-squared, as Parks and Parker. So your choice, which comes, Department of Law or Department of Corrections? Department of Law. Both of you, come up, please. We can get two birds, one stone. And if you will identify yourself and whom you're representing, and we will proceed.
For the record, I'm Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Department of Law. Portia Parker, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Would your choice at who starts first reflect on what you see this bill and the implications of your agency, and we would ask you to share, you know, the potential of what impact this has for the good of Alaskans.
Mr. You want me to? Thanks. I guess I'll start first, just on behalf of the department, criminal division. You know, we fully support this bill. I think it follows many changes that this legislature has done over the last several years, targeting sex offenses and really sending a message that it is a priority to this state, that we're not going to tolerate this behavior and we're going to consider it really of the most serious offenses. I think traditionally homicide has been the most serious, you know, offense in people's mind, but I think as we become
more aware of how prevalent it is with the polygraphs, with the information coming out. I think we see the damage in the lives and generations that sex offenses can have. And I think, you know, Senator French's bill upping sentences previously, taking away good time. Last year, the legislature upped the maximum of unclassified sex offenses to 99, again, recognizing these are as horrific as homicides. And so I support this bill because I think it's another step in that regard. I think it's very positive. I guess in terms of the polygraph, and Ms. Parker will speak more specifically on that, I guess the one comment I'd like to make is normally what we are doing is reacting to things that have already happened. Something bad happens, the police investigate, it comes to my office. I see the polygraph portion of this bill as a very positive sort of preventive measure that we don't often get an opportunity to do, and so I fully support that as well. I think that's a really important piece. I sat in on the presentation last session when Department of Corrections had some experts come up on this, and it really educated me, and I very much support that despite the cost. This will have a cost, and we don't know what it's going to be. You up sentences, there is going to be less incentive for defendants to plead. And so we are anticipating that this may create additional trials. And I guess getting specifically to some questions and issues that were raised, you know, plea bargaining, I think that, you know, I can say confidently that plea bargaining is going to continue for a couple of reasons. And I think first and foremost, these are some of the most difficult cases to prosecute. And I think in many ways it's has to do with the type of offense it is. It's a very difficult offense. But when you're dealing with children particularly, I can tell you, if you have a 2 or 3 year old victim, you may not be sure that your victim's even going to be found competent to testify. And so as a prosecutor, you may be saying to yourself, well, I got to get something out of this, because if the judge finds my victim isn't competent to testify, the whole case goes away. You may have parents in your office, I've had this happen, pleading with me, please don't make my child take the stand. Please don't put my child through this. And so you've got to weigh the public good of putting a pedophile away and force this child and family to go through it versus maybe plea bargaining down. So those are the kinds of issues we face every day in prosecuting these cases. The other reality is the system can't allow every case to go to trial. I think the latest survey I saw that the Judicial Council did said that 4% of all felony cases go to trial. And despite 4% going to trial, which sounds very small, we have a huge backlog, and you may or may not be aware there's been a bill introduced by the governor to increase the number of Superior Court judges around the state to try to deal specifically with the criminal backlog. Bob Linton, the Anchorage DA, has been keeping track of felony trials that have been backing up, and right now on the average this year there's about 300 felony trials waiting for trial. That includes 12 homicides, and we've only got 3 judges doing criminal trials. So those are kind of some of the realities we're dealing with. But I think overall, despite plea bargaining, I think what Senator Bundy said is in fact the case, that even with plea bargaining, when you up the sentences this much, you're going to be putting sex offenders behind bars for much longer than they're going behind bars now. And I think that's positive. And then once they're out, they're going to be polygraphed. I think the other real important piece of this is recognizing that there are some people who just simply should never get out. And what you will see if you look carefully through the bill is, for example, an unclassified sex offense, if you're convicted of that and you've got 2 prior sex felonies, you're going to have a mandatory 99-year sentence. And you know, I think that that's the right message to send, is how many victims are we going to let you have before we just lock you up for life? You can't live with ordinary people anymore. And the same is true for an A felony sex offense. If you've got two prior sex felonies, it's going to be a mandatory 99-year sentence. And so I think that is very positive. And I'd be happy to answer any specific questions.
Senator Terrio?
So, Susan, the issue, the expense of the mandatory sentence, and has the department really thought about how much we need to up the sentence as a deterrent? I mean, there is a deterrent factor there. But then to just automatically keep them off the street versus having the polygraphing so that we're not, you know, housing and feeding them for, you know, a huge number of years if we can keep them on the straight and narrow after they've been identified, and then we have the follow-up, which, you know, has got to be cheaper than, you know, keeping them behind bars. So I'm not sure if you can answer that, or if we have to hear from Portia on the success of the polygraphing on keeping somebody from going, you know, going back to their bad ways.
Senator Terror, through the chair, I guess I think that if you've got two prior sex offenses and you get convicted of another, I mean, frankly, that may be one bite too many. So I think that's a very appropriate. In terms of the ranges that are being set up, and in the bill, you'll see that the new ranges, they're higher for victims under 13, so it's really targeting offenders with children, and then a little bit lower for a victim 13 or over. I can't answer that with any precision. I don't know if there's really data that says this is the amount that will keep them behind bars. I do think, you know, the testimony we've heard shows that there are going to be more victims, and the longer we can keep them behind bars, the fewer victims we're going to have. And I think there's a mandatory 10-year probation in here, which again will give us the opportunity to monitor them that long. And so part of the sentence, which can be suspended, may never have to be imposed because the use of the polygraph will be monitoring them so closely. Now, Ms. Parker, maybe you.
I can elaborate a little bit on that. One thing that we're told over and over again, whether it's the U.S. Department of Justice training from the Center for Sex Offender Management or ATSA training for the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, whether you're talking to treatment providers, probation officers, or polygraph examiners who work in other states and have been using polygraph for a long time, like Oregon, Colorado, Vermont, Connecticut, Florida, Texas, they will tell you that the process of the polygraph used while on probation, specialized supervision for probation officers who are trained to supervise sex offenders, because it's a very specific type of supervision, use with the polygraph examiner is the best we can get as far as best practice when you're supervising and managing sex offenders in the community. You still will have a lot more victims. Even with that, even with the best supervision we know of, you will have a higher rate of revocations, particularly initially, because when you first introduce the polygraph, you'll start learning a lot more information that no one knew. The treatment providers didn't know, the probation officers didn't know. So it may escalate for a while until offenders realize that I better just tell the truth and tell them what's going on so that then they can be managed better. Now, obviously, you're going to have some offenders, your lower risk offenders, and those more amenable to changing their behavior are going to be better under supervision. We do know from studies, particularly in Colorado, that once the containment model, including polygraph, is implemented fully, that offenders tend to be more successful completing probation and parole supervision. About 69% to 70% are successful, rather than without polygraph in there in that supervision. I think it's about, what's it, 26% compliance rate without it. So it's marginal improvement, and it's best practice, and we absolutely should be doing that. Now, you do have offenders who are so high risk and so dangerous that we don't think this is going to do a lot. for them. There are a certain number of sex offenders who are a certain class, then, and most agree, both probation parole officers and their treatment providers and those doing risk assessments on them will say, this person is extremely dangerous. They're getting out. I mean, right now, they're getting out. They're being released, and they're under supervision. We hope some of them may not be if they flat time and they aren't have no probation, and we do the best we can. But what we see as the best way to deal with this is that those who are so dangerous, your repeat offenders, your psychopaths, those who have no desire to change and no intent to be law-abiding or change their behavior, that for public safety, long sentences are really the only way to deal with a certain type of offender. And what that allows us to do is then deal with the other offenders, who sex offenders who are getting out, who have your maybe C's or B's, or who we can work with and have some impact with, because with the polygraph and treatment and supervision, they are more likely to be successful at trying to control their behavior. Still, our best hope is to extend relapse as long as we can. And with sex offenders, it's always a risk of relapse, even if they have been through treatment. I mean, I have to say that some do learn how to control their behavior, but it's constant. They have to be constantly controlling what they want to do, because generally, sex offenders are engaging in this behavior because they want to and they like it. And you're trying to change that behavior, which is very, very difficult. And polygraph certainly helps us with that. And the best thing about polygraph is it gives you a lot of information. And you share that information with the treatment provider, with the supervising officer, and then with law enforcement. And that helps protect the public, and there's no doubt of the benefits of that. It will prevent some crimes, we hope. We will be able to intervene more quickly and get corrective action. We will see some relapse behavior starting through that and be able to have intermediate sanction, more home visits, more office visits, more treatment, try to clamp down and tighten down on that offender as we see them starting to slip into their assault cycle. And obviously, if it's becoming so dangerous and we're worried about that, the probation officer will make the decision on whether to file a revocation to try to intervene more quickly. But it's only successful as much as the offender wants to change and comply, and for as long as we have them on probation. And I think even treatment providers will say that that's the best you can hope for. Now, once they get off, successfully off probation, 10 years from after that or 5 years, it's relapse is likely.
Secretary.
Well, and that's why I'm just wondering, you know, does it make more sense to have longer probation? If in fact the treatment, the following them and the polygraphs is successful and keeping them in, you know, on the straight and narrow, you know, is that a better expenditure of the state's dollar? And can you tell me what have other states that have been using the polygraph for a long period of time experienced? And, you know, as far as being able to look inside, we're not going to be able to rewire the person's brain, but this is about as close as we're going to get to be able to look inside. And I've got to think that as far as somebody, whether they are going to treatment and really engaging in trying to, you know, retrain themselves or steer themselves away from the danger zone, the fact that is it a weekly basis or a monthly basis? Now, I better not put myself in that situation, because at the end of the week, I know they're going to ask me this question, this question, this question, and I'm not going to be able to avoid answering the question. I mean, what success has there been?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there is success with when used with treatment and supervision with the polygraph. And what offenders who've been interviewed say is that it's like having a 24/7 leash, because they know that in 3 months, usually it's a quarterly type, 3-4 times a year, depending on if they're involved in some dangerous behavior, we need to do a specific issue polygraph. Both the treatment provider and the probation officer say, this guy is slipping, you need to get him in and ask him about this particular incident and find out whether that occurred or not, or if he's telling us what actually occurred or the truth. But there is some success with those where they're engaging and are complying. Sometimes they'll take a while. They will be deceptive on a polygraph, and then they'll have to come back in and do it again. And they'll keep coming back in and working with their treatment provider to come back in and take another polygraph until they become non-deceptive. If they don't, then we have to do other interventions. But I guess my main point is that it will work with some offenders, and in that way it will probably be quite successful. It may not work for a lot of other offenders. And we won't really know that until we start and see what we find out, what kind of information we're getting. One of the impacts that we have been warned about is that from other states when they first started was everyone's in shock. The provider, the supervising officer, the polygraph examiner, at the amount of victims. It's staggering. And so people immediately, we're trying to prepare for that, but it's difficult until you start getting into and realizing how much you don't know and didn't know, and both the behavior they're engaging in right while they're on probation and parole, as well as their past behavior, the actual number of victims compared to their criminal record. Some other states have lifetime probation for certain level sex offenders. They'll have level 1, level 2, and level 3, depending on risk. And it's still, it's just a policy call on the risk to victims. The only way to make sure they're not out there offending and having more victims is incarceration. But, you know, everything we do in corrections involves risk.
Secretary, can you tell me, are we obligated under the Compact Act, Interstate Compact, to accept sex offenders from other states, allow them to come into the state? What are the agreements there? And if so, how many, any idea how many we have accepted from other jurisdictions?
Mr. Chairman, Secretary, I don't know that right off the top of my head. I do know that we have now, with the new Interstate Compact guidelines, where it's a lot easier for our offenders to go to other states and other offenders to come to our state. But we do, I believe we do have the ability to say no, that offender can't come here under certain conditions. And I'm not sure exactly what those are, but I can find out.
Okay, and if somebody was convicted of a sex offense in another jurisdiction that doesn't have polygraph, and they come to the state of Alaska, will we be able to impose that on them?
Absolutely, because our offenders are experiencing that in other states and are requesting to come back to Alaska because, as one offender put it, the whole polygraph thing was not working out for him. And another consideration, Mr. Chairman, is that, and one of our staff members is researching this just to see exactly how many other states have pending legislation with the similar to Jessica's law in Florida, which is the 20 to 25 year mandatory sentence for sexual abuse of a minor, to see how many other states are going to be doing that and whether how the impact may be on Alaska if we have a 8 to 12 year sentence.
Senator Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions about polygraphs and one about the sentences. On the polygraphs, do you anticipate adding the polygraph condition of probation to folks who are currently in prison? That is, will we be able to require folks who didn't have this condition added when they were convicted undergo polygraph testing when they get out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, we have a project right now for those sex offenders who are being released on parole to get a special condition added on parole, but we only have enough ability to handle about 30 offenders releasing to South Central right now. We just started that this month, and we have a polygraph examiner on contract that is from the state of Washington, because we have no one in the state of Alaska right now who is qualified to do that with the post-conviction sex offender specific polygraph, which takes special training. And what we have asked is for us to be able to make sure that we have enough staff and contractors to be able to do this, is have a delayed effective date so that we can adopt regulations, have standards in place, and get more than one polygraph examiner to be able to do the work. So the conditions certainly can be amended. I don't think there's anything prohibiting that. They could do that right now. We are specifically asking it for our high-risk offenders who are releasing so that we can get them in the containment model be added as a condition of their parole. We haven't done probation, so we don't have the ability to do this for all the sex offenders releasing right now.
And that leads to my second question, which is my impression has always been that the probation officers that you employ are very busy individuals. And so my question is how many will these folks be trained to polygraph? Will you have specific polygraph administrators or examiners? Mm-hmm. And if so, how do you cover the state? How does a person on probation in Nome or Ketchikan undergo a polygraph if there's only two or three examiners? How many do you intend to employ, and how are you going to deploy them?
Mr. Chairman, right now we do not have our officers on staff. It's not our intent to have them be the polygraph examiners. What our intent is to contract with providers who this is all they do, pretty much, are sex offender specific post-conviction polygraphs on sex offenders. In other states, there are a lot of them. I know when Colorado first started in 89, and then it became a statewide mandate that all sex offenders be polygraphed as a condition of probation and parole, that they went from 2 to 33. Now they have 33 polygraph examiners in their state who are certified and meet their state standards. And so what we're hoping is that we will aggressively go out and let people know that if the legislation passes, that at this time we will have more demand and services available, and we'll continue to contract with different providers. And it's recommended from other states to have more than one provider, that in case there's a dispute on a polygraph, you can have another examiner do that and see if they come up with the same findings. We're planning to videotape all polygraph examinations and continue with the regulations that Oregon, Washington, Colorado, other states have come to, that standards that are in place to both protect the state, the department, the offender, and the whole process. Now, obviously, we will have to have our contractors travel. And with the equipment now, it's a lot easier to do that, to go to remote locations and to travel to different areas of the state. Right now, we are just doing it in Anchorage because that's where those 30 offenders are going to be releasing into Anchorage. Because a whole component of this also is treatment, and we're trying to get more treatment providers in the community too, and it's a difficult field. But what we've been told from other states is you begin the whole process, they will come. Your providers and those we've talked to are polygraph examiners in other states that would love to come to Alaska, but there's just no demand here. There's no work. So I think it will take a little time, and we have a lot to work out and plan for that. And we're working on a 5-year implementation plan right now for the containment model, and it won't happen immediately, but I think that pretty soon we will have enough providers to be able to meet the demand.
Thank you. And on the sentences, I suppose you can expect a challenge to this law, a court challenge. We're raising the stakes dramatically, and so I would imagine folks will want to come in and, try to undermine what the legislature's trying to do here. One of the areas that I think if you look ahead and think ahead, you can be concerned about folks saying, well, this, suddenly you're taking this crime and elevating it above all others, kidnapping, murder. Right now, I think the range for kidnapping is 5 to 99. The range for murder in the second degree is, I think, 10 to 99. And so I guess, particularly for murder in the second degree, I'm concerned about what arguments could be made that we're inverting things, or we're not there's a legal claim to be made there, and I guess I want to try to head it off before it gets traction.
Through the chair, if I could just address that, Senator French. I think that is a concern, and in working and with Senator Bundy's office, we discussed that very thing. Particularly, this bill raises the maximum penalties for B and C felonies to 99 years as well, and currently for other, you know, that goes from 10 to 99 for C felony sex offenses and 20 to 99. That is a dramatic jump. So I do encourage the legislature to put on the record the basis, the policy reasons, the findings behind why these changes are being made. You know, I do think it's to send a message, and there are good, solid policy reasons, but I do encourage you to put those on the record, maybe even a letter of intent, whatever might be appropriate to justify this, because I believe you're correct. There very well could be a legal challenge to this kind of dramatic increase.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond for maybe Senator Bundy and myself, the Department of Law has made us aware, and we're working on findings and intent and how to document within the process what we need to document for that court challenge. So anything or any insight you have, given all the work you've done on this issue, would be appreciated.
Senatorial.
Susan, when you're in court, is a letter of intent good enough, or does it need to be findings that get put in one section of the statutes?
Through the chair, I think findings, you know, are always better. I mean, a letter of intent certainly clarifies what your intent was, but actual findings sort of give the basis and the facts you relied on to reach the conclusion you reached. And this would be something on appeal. I mean, this is something that would end up in the appellate courts. You know, the trial level, somebody's going to have to get convicted, someone's going to have to get sentenced, and then on appeal, that's where we'll be arguing that. So the more documentation, the better, I think, the more. I know Ms. Parker's provided, or in the packet, there's been some studies, some information on studies. Any of that that can be part of the record also is something we'll be able to look to on appeal to justify the changes that the legislature ultimately makes.
Okay. And one other thing, the offenders who are currently on parole, can it be added to their parole requirements?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, it can be. I believe the process is that it has to be requested as an additional parole condition, and the parole board has to have a hearing, and then they will decide whether to add it as an additional condition of parole.
Okay, so you don't have to have a breach of parole or have them go back through the system to add it. You can just add it.
I believe so, yes.
There he goes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up, Given the bill that we passed on no good time, and we have an issue now because we don't automatically get probation or parole, and that, can we in this bill go back and deal with that and have the automatic probation and parole? I don't think we can, but can you get back on whether or not we could, with people that are currently in jail, which is kind of what I heard in Senator Tyria's question, the current people in jail, can we get them on polygraph or get them on probation within this bill, or is it just forward-looking?
Senator Guest, through the chair, people who've already been sentenced and conditions of probation have already been set by a judge, I can do some more research, but I do not believe that this could now be added as a condition of probation. On the case law, I mean, that would be a modification of their sentence that I don't believe you could legislate in, but that's something I'd be happy to check on in terms of probation. Probation's different than parole.
And Mr. Chairman, with parole, if the offender does not have good time and they are not on mandatory parole, they serve their entire sentence, there's no supervision unless they already have probation.
Okay, well, we, I think, had an expectation of we would conclude at 10:30, and we will conclude at 10:35, it appears. Just a couple comments, though. Number one, I think all of us miss Chairman Seekins. Update is that he will be back with us today. later on this afternoon. We'll be glad to see his face. And I would like to say for each of us that there's, and on behalf of the committee, there are some people in this room that make things work. And since it's our initial meeting, we say proactively, thank you for everything you're going to do with us and for us to make this system work for us on a daily basis. So thank you. And
Mr. Sir. Chairman, before we gavel, just one other thing that my staff caught. On one of the fiscal notes, it says written by the administration component public defender agency, but the signature down below is the director of OPA. And so I wasn't sure whether we just have a little technical problem with that fiscal note. But anyway.
We'll look into it.
Whoever's coordinating the fiscal notes.
Okay. With that, we're adjourned.